We will now begin to look at several prominent examples of martyrs and visionaries in the early church who give us an insight into the process of spiritual guidance and direction as it was understood and applied in these early decades of Christianity. I would like to set all of this against the background of one of the most important images or symbols of how Christ saves that emerges in the early church and remains especially prominent and important in the Eastern churches today. And that is what we might call the icon, the image, the tradition, although it is based in a very limited kind of way on a biblical text, the tradition of Christ's descent into hell. Now, of course, this is an article of the Creed, but what we mean by this is something that we really have to look back to the early centuries of the church in order to understand. It helps us also to acquire a sense of how experiences and events can be given a new meaning by applying to them the passion, death, and resurrection of Christ. That is, in meditation on those events in Christ's life, one begins to experience the possibility of God breaking into every kind of human experience and giving new meaning, even to what seemed to be separation and suffering, through the agency, of course, of our prayer and relationship with Christ, but also, as we'll particularly see in the texts concerning the Passion of the Martyrs, our relationships with one another, and in particular, our sense of connectedness with the whole church, but with specific individuals who come to be for us representatives of this ongoing, consecrating, sanctifying action of Christ in our own day, and also people to whom we can literally appeal for models, for examples, and for intercession. Well, let's look specifically at this tradition of the descensus ad inferos, the descent into hell. It's based on a biblical text from 1 Peter, which you have before you, and this is really all there is in the scriptures about this. It's very obscure, very limited. Notice in verse 18, Christ also died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, and then in which he went and preached to the spirits in prison, kai tois en phulake, to those who were literally in chains, who were enchained in this place. Now, clearly it is a reference to Christ going into the abode of the dead, into the place of those who were chained. What it means specifically metaphysically is not clarified in this particular text, but very quickly, and of course the letter of Peter is a fairly late epistle in the New Testament corpus, early in Christian experience after the age of the apostles, this event, which represents a kind of an applying of Christ's passion, death, and resurrection to the experiences of suffering humanity, but also in a broad way to those who have gone before us in faith, and also as a conviction of how Christ reaches out to the human experience of being enchained, being imprisoned, becomes a matter of ongoing Christian speculation. And we have a window into the way Christians thought about this and reflected on it in some of the very intriguing, some of them are rather silly, but apocryphal texts, the various revelations and acts of the apostles that began to be written in the first and second centuries, the late first, but mostly in the second century, and to some limited extent also a little bit later than that, these texts that attempt to answer questions that ordinary Christians were asking, things as seemingly trivial as what did Jesus do when he was a little boy, what did Mary do when she was a little girl, and what did Christ do when he descended into hell. And in many ways, this is a more important question because it not only touches the question of how does the salvation extend to those who have already died, but it also asks the broader question, how can we understand Christ's saving acts as penetrating into the greatest region of darkness and separation that we can imagine? And probably one of the most beautiful condensations, elaborations, and then theological reflections on this tradition is, if you drop down, this ancient homily for Holy Saturday. And it's a reminder of the fact that the icon of the Anastasis, which literally means the resurrection, in the Eastern Church is not actually Christ rising from the tomb. Instead, the resurrection icon, even to this day in Eastern churches, is actually what we would call the descent into hell. And you have a modern adaptation of the beautiful Anastasis depiction in the Kora Monastery in Constantinople, here of Christ reaching down with his right and his left hands, literally lifting, pulling Adam and Eve out of hell, Sheol, Hades, however you want to describe the place of separation from God or the abode of the dead, and bringing them with him into heaven. Our first parents standing for, symbolizing, but also in a very real, metaphysical way, actually being us. Christ reaching into the place of separation and drawing forth those who were formerly separated, who were formerly kept away from him. And I've put as a kind of a counterpoise to that an image we've already seen from the Beautiful Hours of the Duke of Berry, Christ healing even in the midst of violence. Now that's a Western image, and it's actually from roughly the same time, a bit later, but it's obviously has a very similar iconographic characteristics, the curving figure of Christ, his reaching out with his hand, and the hand being the saving or the healing hand. The homily itself is intended liturgically now to be read, at least in the Roman Catholic Church, on Holy Saturday. It is the meditation in the heart of the Triduum. This is the text that one is supposed to use to meditate on, to make sense of the experience of having already experienced the liturgies of Holy Thursday and the meditation on the Passion of Good Friday. Now one is holding those things in the heart, seeking to extract the meaning of them, and looking forward to the kindling of the new fire at the Easter Vigil. That's the placement of this text now. And what it is a beautiful description of how all the events of Christ's Passion are for the purpose of healing some kind of brokenness in sinful humanity. And this is a beautiful explanation of the tradition of meditation on the Passion. Meditation on the Passion is not simply a kind of experience of empathy with suffering. It has that characteristic, but if it stops there, it does not serve a purpose other than to evoke a kind of a feeling within the heart. The goal of this homily is to help us realize that when we meditate on the Passion, we are seeing through into God's love, not just, oh, look how God suffers, but look how in suffering God reaches into our experience of separation, isolation, loneliness, and draws that experience into union with himself. No human experience is incapable of being reclaimed by God. God can reach out and consecrate everything. He stepped into every kind of human brokenness, every experience of evil, every kind of cruelty that can be offered, and God has made all of those things into a way that leads ultimately to himself. So what this means from the standpoint, of course, of spiritual guidance and direction is that all human experiences, everything that has happened to us, everything in our relationships, everything that connects us with those whom we love, all of that has the potential for being touched by Christ and given new meaning. So this is a homily all about new meaning, how the Triduum, the meditation on the Passion, Death, and Resurrection of Christ is for us a source of discovering new meaning in our own lives and in our own history, symbolized by, powerfully characterized by this description of Christ going into hell and rescuing, healing, explaining to Adam and Eve what each of the events of the Passion really were and really were about. So let's look at this very beautiful text. It begins, something strange is happening. What is this that is happening? Literally in the Greek, there is a great silence on earth today. The very ancient tradition that when the king is touched by either joy or sorrow or pain, the whole land is affected or afflicted. And so the king of the universe, having died, the whole earth is keeping silence. Holy Saturday is a day of great silence and of stillness. The earth keeps silence because the king is asleep. The earth trembled and is still because God has fallen asleep, literally died in the flesh, and has raised up those who have slept since the world began. God has died in the flesh and hell trembles with fear. The place of captivity, the experience of limitation, of brokenness and separation is trembling with fear because it's about to have to release its captives. He's gone to search for our first parents as for a lost sheep. So here in this image, the notion of Christ the Savior is coupled with what we've already looked at, this image of Christ the Good Shepherd who seeks out the good sheep, the lost sheep, desiring to visit those in darkness and the shadow of death. References to the Psalms, to Psalm 23. He has gone to free from sorrow the captives Adam and Eve. He who is both God and the Son of Eve. Christ is healing. Christ is able to go and search for and heal his first parents because he is both the creator of the universe and, paradoxically, beautifully, the Son, the descendant of those whom he is going to heal. He has the power to heal because he is both God and human. He can touch them in his humanity with his divinity and utterly transform what it means to be human. The Lord approaches them. There's this beautiful little almost liturgical interaction. My Lord be with you, Christ replies, and with your spirit. An application of the liturgy to this event, a kind of a Christian meditation on liturgy and on soteriology, the theology of salvation. Christ takes Adam by the hand and says, "Awake, O sleeper, rise from the dead. Christ will give you life." Explains who he is. "I am your God who for your sake have become your son. Out of love for you and your descendants, I command those in bondage to come forth, those in darkness to be enlightened, the sleepers to awake. I did not create you to be held a prisoner in hell. Arise from the dead, for I am the life of the dead." Christ can touch death because he has died and is alive, is the life of the dead. "Arise, work of my hands." He reaches out to us, to our old Adam, and we who are the work of his hands, the plasma ta'emon, we are that which he has made, and now his own creating hands can reach out and touch and refashion that which he himself originally created. "Arise, my likeness, you who were created in my image." Let us leave this place because you are in me and I am in you. Su en emoi kago en soi. Right out of the wonderful high priestly prayer in St. John's Gospel, that they may be one. It's been achieved. Christ is now stating that this is the case. You are in me, I am in you. This union with Christ means that together, he says, we form only one person. We cannot be separated. We are inseparable. "I, your God, became your son." He's saying this to Adam. "I, the Lord, took the form of a slave. I, whose home is in heaven, descended to the earth and beneath the earth." And then this beautiful parallelism. Each of the events of the Passion is now applied both to the beginning of creation, to our own beginning, and given a whole new meaning. For your sake, I became a man without help, free among the dead. For the sake of you who left a garden, the garden is for humanity the symbol of what we've left behind. I was betrayed in a garden and crucified in a garden. This old tradition that it was somehow in the garden itself, the Garden of Gethsemane, that both Christ's betrayal and in a mysterious way also the crucifixion took place, which is a pilgrimage tradition in the Holy Land, of course. Whether it's geographically true is another question. But here we have a beautiful parallelism. Christ is betrayed in and crucified in a garden to reconsecrate the garden. Christ's death, Christ's betrayal means that the garden is no longer a place of separation, no longer the place from which we were expelled or in which he was betrayed. His own resurrection redeems and purifies and makes new the whole notion of the garden. The garden again has become the place wherein we can live. Then each of the events of the Passion, "On my face the spittle I received to restore to you the life that I once breathed in you." What a beautiful and astonishing parallelism. The most horrific form of abuse and contempt, to spit in the face of another, Christ says, this is to restore effectively the kiss of life that I once breathed into you. You offer me contempt, I kiss life back into you. He takes contempt, makes it into new life, makes it into literally a sign of union, a sign of love. The marks, the blows that I received to refashion your warped nature in my image. The wounds of Christ are no longer simply something we stare at in order to experience empathetic suffering. They are literally, each one of them, the empathetic transformation of each wound in our nature. Christ somehow receives a wounding, transforms it into healing and resurrection, and thus our wounds are mysteriously, kind of magically, this was a notion of medicine in antiquity, that which causes a wound needs to be involved in the process of healing. This notion is being used in a very metaphysical way to say all of the events of the Passion are about our healing. We are to experience them as something that touches the wounds inside of us. My hands nailed to a tree for you who stretched out your hand to a tree. The hand of betrayal reaching out to the tree, that ultimately meant separation or expulsion from Eden, now becomes, as it were, both destroyed and healed in. He says, "My side has healed the pain in yours." It's so beautiful here that he is describing the piercing of his side with the lance, which is in some sense analogous to and giving new meaning to the pain of childbirth. The side from which Eve was created, the whole reference to the garden of the fact of new life for human beings also entailing pain. Christ is somehow healing the pain that results in new life. My sleep rouses you from your sleep in hell. The sword that pierced me has sheathed the sword, the angel's sword, the sword, the flaming cherubim, symbol of expulsion from and keeping out of the Garden of Eden. That sword is now sheathed because Christ has overcome death. The sword that pierced him, or the lance in that case, has caused the angel's sword to be sheathed. So effectively, what you have here is a kind of beautiful, liturgically based but spiritually focused emphasis on Christ undoing all the wrongs in detail that exist in human experience and leave scars in the human psyche and in human personality as well. And his response is, "Arise, let us leave this place." So there's a resurrection. Let us rise up, leave the place of death, the place of separation, the Sheol or hell. The enemy led you out of earthly paradise. I will not restore you to that paradise. I will enthrone you in heaven. So that which Christ does in his healing is to restore a greater dignity than the one that was lost. Not the earthly paradise, but enthroning in heaven. I forbade you the tree that was only a symbol of life, but I, who am life itself, am now one with you. Whereas the source of scandal in Eden was the tree of life, the possibility of living forever, now Christ says, you have eternal union with myself. I am one with you. Henothen soi, hezoe. You are forever united, made one with Christ who is life. The cherubim guarded us as slaves to keep us out of the garden, but now he says, I make them worship you as if you were a god. You hid yourselves as if naked from God, but behold, hidden within you is God, nakedly, really, truly. The throne formed by the cherubim awaits bridles swift and eager. And then the bridal chamber is adorned, the banquet is ready, the eternal places are prepared, the treasure houses of all good things lie open. So this is a beautiful eschatological vision at a time in the history of the church where the focus was shifting from a literal historical eschatological expectation, expecting the kingdom to come literally very soon, to what does it mean that the kingdom does in fact come, that we are destined for the kingdom of heaven at our death, and that somehow begins to be lived out in our lives even before that. So from the perspective of spiritual guidance, spiritual direction, what we see here is a bringing together of traditions in regard to the significance of Christ's suffering, the powerful symbol and historical tradition of Christ's descent into hell as having even more meaning than the historical event itself. the meaning being that it is itself a kind of healing, an entry into all that is darkened and separated. Christ has the power to heal, to renew, and then to give new life, a new form, a new unexpected greater reality than existed before, and that's in our relationship with the Lord. As we'll see in other sources, that living relationship with the Lord, which is itself healing, a source of transformation, is also experienced in our relationships with one another, and especially in a very visible and powerful way in the relationships we have with those whose lives, experience, and power of intercession and guidance are themselves a visible representation of and continuation of Christ's own ministry of healing. That is to say, in the early church, the notion of the martyrs.